Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WFCA LP 106.1 FM Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, May 27th, 2006. Today, our focus is on water. Here's what we have coming up. An interview with Olivia Zink from Save Our Groundwater, updating us on last week's New Hampshire Supreme Court decision, followed by an interview of Robert Glennon, the author of Water Follies, The Impact of Groundwater Pumping on the Environment. Our second hour will begin with the Newmarket, New Hampshire Elementary School Kids on Peace segment that we couldn't play last week due to technical difficulties. We'll then hear a bit of extreme news, commentary by Michael Parente, and labor news. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. We'll also have music, some of our hidden history, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. New York City Mayor advocates U.S. worker database, from the Associated Press. Republican Mayor Michael Bloomberg thrust himself into the national immigration debate Wednesday, advocating a plan that would establish a DNA or fingerprint database to track and verify all legal U.S. workers. Bloomberg compared his proposed federal identification database to the Social Security card, insisting that such a system would not violate citizens' privacy and was not a civil liberties issue. Donna Lieberman, director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, said a DNA or fingerprint database, quote, doesn't sound like the free society we think we're living in. It will inevitably be used not just by employers, but by law enforcement, government agencies, schools, and all over the private sector, she said. And from Energy Washington Week, the White House has created an internal working group of selected federal agency officials to accelerate the expansion of nuclear power in the country. A revival of the U.S. nuclear industry is a priority for the Bush administration, which argues that nuclear offers a reliable, no-emissions source of power for meeting the nation's growing energy needs. The nuclear power industry has mounted an aggressive campaign to generate public and political support for the construction of a new fleet of nuclear plants, the first that would be built in the United States in decades. The group was formed to advance nuclear energy as a core piece of President Bush's Advanced Energy Initiative, which was announced earlier this year and seeks a 22% increase in funding for so-called clean energy technology research at the Department of Energy. In addition to investments in nuclear energy, the initiative seeks the accelerated development of zero-emission coal-fired plants and solar and wind technologies. The licensing process continues to come under fire from some in the nuclear industry, who say changing rules and the slow pace are major barriers to achieving a true nuclear renaissance in the U.S. over the next two decades. The industry is also exasperated by continued federal government delays in advancing construction of the Yucca Mountain, Nevada nuclear waste repository. And from a New Hampshire Peace Action press release, eight more activists found guilty of seeking Senator Gregg accountability. On May 25th, eight peace and justice activists known as the Concord Eight were found guilty of criminal trespass by Judge Sullivan in Concord District Court. Each defendant was fined $500, which the judge suspended, predicated on good behavior for 1 year. The defendants were found guilty of staying past closing at Senator Judd Gregg's Concord office on December 5, 2005. The action was the eighth attempt to secure a public meeting with the senator to discuss exit strategies from Iraq. The judge denied defense attorneys Stephen Cherry and Jennifer Jones's motion to allow the expert witness testimony of Ray McGovern, a 27-year veteran of the CIA. McGovern was prepared to testify to the manipulation of pre-war intelligence used to justify the invasion of Iraq in March 2003, and that the war is illegal under U.S. and international law. He said, Congress's authorization of force was tied specifically to the attacks of September 11, 2001. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, as President George W. Bush admitted publicly in September 2003. The Nuremberg Tribunal ruled that, quote, initiating a war of aggression is the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only in that it contains the accumulated evil of the whole. Nuremberg also ruled that when an individual learns of, or is ordered to commit, a war crime, he or she is legally bound to do all that is possible to expose and end it. Each defendant gave testimony on his or her behalf as to why he or she engaged in civil disobedience. Jack Bopp, a rehabilitation counselor, spoke from a place of faith. As an aspiring Christian, I believe my primary responsibility is to seek justice and make peace in a hungry and war-torn world. Mike Franklin, another defendant, said in response to the guilty verdict, "We all share responsibility for actions done in our name by our government. What will we tell our children when they ask us what we did to stop a criminal war?" During the penalty phase, each defendant made a statement. Jamila El-Shafai told the judge, "I do take full responsibility for my action. I pray that Senator Gregg will accept responsibility for his." Actions are planned at all 14 New Hampshire congressional offices on May 31st. And from the Associated Press, House votes to cut aid to Palestinians. The House voted to further choke off the flow of U.S. aid to the Hamas-controlled Palestinian Authority, drawing the displeasure of the Bush administration and dividing the pro-Israel lobbying community. The measure, approved 361-37, would cut off aid to non-governmental groups working in the West Bank and Gaza, except for health programs, and would deny visas to members of the Palestinian Authority. It also would ban contacts with Hamas because of its classification as a terrorist organization and limit the president's authority to waive the aid bans. The administration believes the legislation goes too far. The vote on the Palestinian Anti-Terrorist Act came as Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was meeting President Bush at the White House to discuss Israel's plans to impose a West Bank settlement on the Palestinians. The bill also caused a dispute between AIPAC and Representative Betty McCollum, Democrat of Minnesota, who claimed that an AIPAC representative accused her of supporting terrorism by opposing the bill and banned AIPAC from her office until she gets an apology. And from Yahoo News and Reuters, National Post apologizes for anti-Iran story. A Canadian newspaper apologized on Wednesday for a story that said Iran planned to force Jews and other religious minorities to wear distinctive clothing to distinguish themselves from Muslims. The conservative National Post ran the story on its front page last Friday, along with a large photo from 1944 which showed a Hungarian couple wearing the yellow stars that the Nazis forced Jews to sew to their clothing. The story, which included tough anti-Iran comments from prominent Jewish groups, was picked up widely by websites and by other media. "Is Iran turning into the new Nazi Germany? Share your opinion online," the paper asked readers last Friday. But the National Post, a longtime supporter of Israel and critic of Tehran, admitted on Wednesday it had not checked the piece thoroughly enough before running it. National Post editor-in-chief Douglas Kelly wrote in a long editorial on page 2, "It is now clear the story is not true. We apologize for the mistake and for the consternation it has caused not just National Post readers, but the broader public who read the story." And from the Times of Britain, civilians die in raid on Taliban. U.S. troops claim to have killed 80 fighters, but raids took a heavy toll on innocent lives. American-led forces in southern Afghanistan claimed to have killed up to 80 fighters in a nighttime airstrike on a Taliban stronghold as violence continued to spread in the region. However, the operation, about 30 miles from Kandahar, left dozens of civilian casualties. Local authorities said that 16 people had been killed, including women and children, and 16 had suffered serious wounds. Asadullah Khalid, the governor of Kandahar, who visited some of the wounded in hospital, urged villagers not to shelter Taliban fighters. He said, "These sorts of accidents happen during fighting, especially when the Taliban are hiding in homes." The airstrike caused extensive damage to the village of Azizi, which is made up mainly of mud-walled compounds. There is no electricity, and water is drawn from a well. It is known as a rebel stronghold, and has been the scene of fighting in recent days. Local anger was vented on the Allied attackers. Ada Mohammed, 60, said, "Oh my God, they killed my kids." His silver beard was streaked with tears, and his hands were covered in blood. "God may take revenge on them. They took everyone from me," he said, his voice crackling with emotion. Haji Ikaf, 40, a villager, said Taliban fighters had taken shelter in a religious school. When the bombing started, they fled into family homes. He said, "Then those homes were bombed. I saw 35 to 40 dead Taliban and around 50 dead or wounded civilians." Zermina Bibi, who was caught in the fighting with her family, cradled her wounded 8-month-old baby as she said that 10 people were killed in her home. "There were dead people everywhere," she wailed. Colonel Tom Collins, a U.S. military spokesman, said, quote, It's common that the enemy fights in close to civilians as a means to protect its own forces. We targeted a Taliban compound, and we're certain we hit the right target. And from the LA Times, certain victory keeps U.S. in Iraq, says Bush. President Bush said he would pull U.S. troops out of Iraq if he didn't think the United States could win the war against terrorism. Bush told the National Restaurant Association convention in Chicago, "If I didn't think it was important that we succeed, I wouldn't stay. And the reason it's important is that we must understand that we're in a global war against a totalitarian group of people who will kill innocent life, there or here, in order to achieve an objective." Bush took a series of friendly questions after his prepared remarks, and more of them concerned the economy than Iraq. In response to one about tax cuts, the president said letting his temporary tax cuts lapse would amount to a tax increase and would be no way to balance the budget. He said, "That's not the way Washington works. The way Washington works is, they will raise your taxes and figure out new ways to spend the money and not balance the budget." He did not mention that federal spending had risen from $1.9 trillion in the year he took office to an estimated $2.7 trillion this year, an increase of 45% in 5 years.
Now for Making Waves interviewer Steve Diamond speaking with Olivia Zink about Save Our Groundwater.
This is Steve Diamond for Making Waves. I'm speaking with Olivia Zink of Save Our Groundwater. Welcome, Olivia, and just give us a little recap of the... I understand there was a legal case that you were working on recently. What exactly was the premises of that case?
Thank you, Steve, for having us on Making Waves. My name's Olivia Zink, and I'm on the board of directors of Save Our Groundwater, and for the last 5 years, we've been fighting a bottled water company that wants to take 310,000 gallons of water a day from the seacoast aquifer to bottle and ship it overseas. And Save Our Groundwater has argued a legal case in front of the Supreme Court with the town of Nottingham and the town of Barrington, stating that surface water and groundwater are integrated public resources to be conserved, managed for the public good. And so the Supreme Court looked at the 5 years of the case, and when USA Springs reapplied, they then received a permit to withdraw the water that belongs to three watersheds in 10 seacoast communities. And basically, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of USA Springs Friday, May 19th. There's no criteria right now that the state looks at public interest when they grant permits. And basically, on page 18 of the decision, there's really no way for the Department of Environmental Services to say no to permits as long as those applications are complete. And so basically, Save Our Groundwater, the towns of Nottingham, the town of Barrington, the residents of 10 seacoast communities lost in a big way when the Supreme Court made these decisions. Fortunately, the state legislature voted in our favor. The House voted to adopt Senate Bill 386 this spring, really tightening up some of those rules. And we had a victory of 79% in the House. Really means that the state legislator is paying attention to these issues and trying to correct the problem. And so hopefully we can work next legislative session to really tie up some of these loopholes and really work towards a sustainable groundwater policy for the future generations. Unfortunately, USA Springs will probably start withdrawing water soon. And so really what we need to do is encourage residents in that 7,000-foot square radius to get a baseline permit, because this New Hampshire Supreme Court said the burden of proof, if there's anything goes wrong with your well, is left to the residential homeowner to test their wells, and so they have to create a baseline data. So we'll be going out and asking people to get their wells tested, to create baseline data, so that if anything does go wrong, and based on the science, it looks like things will start to happen as soon as they start withdrawing water.
You want the local people to check to see if this withdrawal will lower their wells?
Well, basically, creating a baseline data just says what contaminates in it, how much capacity your well's currently going at. Because if anything does go wrong, you have to prove that it was because of the water withdrawal. So if you have data before they start pumping, it will only help in the long run. Also, the Neighborhood Guardians, which is a group that started after the Planning Board made their decision and the neighborhood guardians have been working in Nottingham. They had a trial that started Monday with their planning board appeals. So the planning board decisions is being looked at in Rockingham Superior Court. And so that case will continue onward. There's also the wetlands appeals, and the Army Corps of Engineers, per the request of Governor John Lynch, has been requested to look into the wetlands issues regarding this case as well.
But getting back to the court case, what exactly was the premise of your case?
The premise of Save Our Groundwater's appeal was that the public interest was not served in the larger withdrawal of 310,000 gallons of water for USA Springs to bottle and ship overseas. We appealed mostly on the public trust doctrine, which says that surface water and groundwater are integrated public resources that belong to collectively all of us. And so when we look at managing water for the common good, we have to look at need. Need was one of the things that we cited. We cited a case about need. The Supreme Court ruled using a much broader definition of need. You know, personally, I believe that we should have policy that has a hierarchy of needs. You know, the needs of our streams. We're sitting next to the beautiful Bellamy River and watching the water flow down. And we need to make sure that there's in-stream flow rules to protect our streams. We need to make sure that there's enough water for residential household use. We need to make sure that there's enough water for farmers to grow their crops. You know, I think those should be a higher priority than the need for USA Springs to profit off of our resource, because we need to think about those things. And hopefully we can convince our legislators to think that we need to think about prioritizing and creating a hierarchy of users and which users are more important. But basically what happened on Friday with the Supreme Court ruling was the need for water in that area has just been allocated to USA Springs. You know, they're putting the biggest straw in and they're pinching off a bunch of other users. And so really what we need to think about is there's only so much water in the cup. And if we put more straws in, we're affecting other straws. And really what we need to figure out is how many straws can we put in that cup, and who should be allowed in priority to put their straw in first.
And who has the deepest straw? What has this decision done to your faith in the legal system to be able to come up with the right answers to society's problems? I understand you're going to continue with the legislature. Are you still going to work with the courts too, or are you going to switch focus a little bit?
Save Our Groundwater is still reviewing the 25-page decision, and we're also still meeting with our attorneys to think about the strategy. The work of Save Our Groundwater will continue. The story that we have to share, we'll share with other community, with local officials, with the state legislator, and to continue to advocate that groundwater is an invaluable resource that we need to work to protect. The work of Save Our Groundwater will continue. We'll still continue to advocate that we need sustainable groundwater policy in New Hampshire. We're still pursuing our options as far as what we need to do.
Was this ruling a surprise for you? It's probably a significant disappointment.
We had waited 7.5 months for this decision. And while we were waiting, the longer we waited, we figured that the Supreme Court was really looking at a lot of these things in depth. This is a record that has over 10,000 pages of record of testimony. It has 5 times the amount of written public comment from citizens than any other permit that DES has seen in the Large Groundwater Withdrawal Division. They've been the biggest case since the Groundwater Act had been passed in 1998. And so really, I was hopeful, I had faith in our legal system, that they would really look at all of those records in depth. Part of the problem, I think, has been for the last 5 years is the Department of Environmental Services have just looked at little pieces of this thing. They've looked at certain wells withdrawing water. They've looked at 2 square feet of wetlands. And they haven't really looked at what the water table holds and the overall hydrology of the area. Very little is known about the fractured bedrock aquifers that they're withdrawing water from. And so when we look at the bigger questions of who owns our water, who should be allowed to take it, we need to fundamentally look at some of the bigger questions of how much water do we have? How much water are we allocating for certain purposes? You know, what is the hierarchy? What are the needs of the community? And how can those needs be met in a sustainable manner? By chopping things into little pieces and just addressing small little pieces of issues, you're not looking at the whole withdrawal itself. You're not looking at it from a holistic perspective. And I think what we need to do is really think about how we can be proactive and look at our water resources and how it is so interconnected to our life and is so fundamental to our life. Without water, we don't have very much. And the property values of the abutting properties, you know, without a working well, you know, they don't have much property values. They looked at very small pieces. Water is just so fundamental to our life and our ecosystem.
This area has certainly grown in population considerably. And I've also heard that perhaps the agricultural activities in the area might be increasing significantly because of high costs of gasoline and high cost of transporting things from other parts of the country and around the world. So it's quite possible that the amount of water needed by the local community could increase significantly in the future.
Yeah, this permit is for 10 years, and they barely looked at the current users, let alone during the application process. Just during the application process, 100 new homes have been built in that impact zone. And so really, when we think about how fast we're developing, we really need to think about how we can develop in a sustainable manner and with sustainable foods, and really think about how we can structure things where we can protect our resource for the common good.
And we've only talked about water as a resource for the common good of people so far. What about is the well-being of nature and the fish and so forth? Even we haven't even gotten there yet.
Well, those weren't even looked at. They didn't do a proper inventory of what the needs were for that ecosystem around there. They did look at a species, turtles in that area, because there's an endangered species of turtles right where USA Springs wants to build. And so that they did look at that. And then what some of the wetlands permitting issues, they did do some inventory of some of the species, but not in how much will be impacted. I mean, and really the problem is we don't have dollar values assigned to our natural resources. You know, water is supposed to be common. It's supposed to be for all of us to use. But there's no dollar amount assigned to, you know, when USA Springs takes it. They just take our resource. And there's been a proposal in Maine to tax that resource. You know, when you cut down a tree in New Hampshire, you pay a timber tax. You know, when you withdraw water, should you be charged a tax? We need to figure out a way that we can assign a value so that it's protected. Is the tax the right answer? We'll see what the state legislators have to say. But really what we need to do is start to think about how we can value that resource and conserve that resource for future generations.
For any listeners who would like to get involved with Save Our Groundwater, how can they best do that?
Save Our Groundwater holds monthly meeting at the Sugar Shack. You can visit www.saveourgroundwater.org. You should be paying attention to who's buying your water resources in your community. Volunteer to be on the water board in your community. 60% of Portsmouth water comes from the Bellamy watershed. You know, pay attention to where your water comes from. Stay active in your conservation commission. There's new ways to try to pass local ordinances that protect your water. We can strengthen the state law in our own community if we feel that we need to. I mean, the Supreme Court decision really shows the state is not doing what they should to protect our water resources. So we as residents can work for local ordinances that really do strengthen that law in our own communities, community by community. And really, then that really will wake up our state legislators to say, okay, you know, each of these communities are really strengthening their own laws and saying that they want a deeper protection of their natural resources.
Indeed, water issues and property rights seem to me to be where local and international world issues kind of collide. I also understand the governor has said very clearly that this sort of thing would not be allowed. Seems like a fight that can actually be won.
It's such a worthwhile fight. And really, what we're fighting for is our life. And really, what we need to do is build a people's movement, you know, globally. We really need to work locally to create a movement that says, you know, water is life, and that we need to have water and delivery infrastructure that provides safe and clean water to ourselves.
Olivia Zink of Save Our Groundwater, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve. It was my pleasure.
And now for Governor Lynch in his State of the State address, speaking to groundwater issues.
New Hampshire is at a crossroads. For four decades now, we have been the fastest growing state in New England. This growth has given us an unparalleled opportunity. But if we are not careful, we could put at risk the very things that make New Hampshire such a great place to live and work. I was disappointed that the budget that was passed did not contain more funding for the Land and Community Heritage Investment Program, which has done so much to protect our natural and our cultural resources. We must continue working together to protect all that makes New Hampshire so special. We need a long-term state policy for protecting our groundwater, an issue that legislative study committees are considering. Until we have that policy in place, we must proceed carefully to avoid further exploitation of our groundwater resources. We must ensure that our citizens and our businesses always have clean, safe drinking water.
Children who weep for love, maker of this birth, to your deepest secrets unknown to me, I will not be moved. I will not be moved. Don't try to find the answer when there ain't no question here. Brother, let your heart be wounded and give no mercy to your fear. Down the street from me, Babylon is every town. It's as crazy as it's ever been. Love's a stranger all around. In the moment we lost our minds here and lay our spirit down. Today we lived a thousand years. All we have is now. Run to the water and find me there. Burn to the core of streets below the moon. These streets below the moon. And I will never leave you till we can say this world was just a dream. We were sleeping, now we are awake. Till we can say, in a moment we lost our minds here and dreamt the world was round. A million miles far from grace, thank God we missed the ground. Run to the water and find me there. Burn to the core but not broken. We cut through the madness of these streets below.
That was Live with Run to the Water. And now for Making Waves interviewer Steve Capron speaking with Robert Glennon about water follies.
This is Steve Capron reporting for Making Waves. We are at the New England Center today with our guest Robert Glennon, who is the author of a book called Water Follies, and he is no stranger to New England, having attended both Brandeis and Boston College. Welcome back.
Well, thanks very much, Steve. It's good to be home.
What got you interested in the whole business of groundwater and water and water law and the environment and so forth?
Well, I was teaching in the Midwest until the mid-80s when I went out to the University of Arizona. And shortly after that, I began teaching water law. Basically, my field is constitutional law, but this seemed like it would be a fun thing to do, and it has become my passion. Shortly after I started teaching it, I hooked up with an interdisciplinary team at the university. The university has the world's best hydrology department. I came to be working with a fellow by the name of Tom Maddock, and we started writing papers together about the insanity of a system that has different rules for groundwater and for surface water, even though the hydrologists tell us that it's all connected.
In your book, you mentioned that the legal system lags very far behind our knowledge of how groundwater works. What would it take to bring the legal system up to the current level of knowledge about groundwater pumping and its consequences and so forth?
Well, a couple of things. One, when the law developed in the mid-19th century, the science of hydrology was in its infancy, and no one knew how water moved beneath the surface of the earth. So judges basically shrugged their shoulders and said, well, if you can get it out, it's yours. And that is almost literally still true, which is to say, your listeners might think of an aquifer as a giant milkshake glass, and think of each well as a straw in the glass. What the law in most states permits is anyone who wants to put a straw into the single finite supply. And that's madness. It's a classic illustration of the tragedy of the commons.
You mentioned Garrett Hardin's famous essay, Tragedy of the Commons, several times in your book. How far along are we in this regard? How are we close to spoiling it for everybody, or is there time to repair what damage is done and avoid further damage in the future?
Well, my book is a wake-up call because we're pretty far down the path, but it's not too late to take some really serious corrective actions. I describe in Water Follies lakes in Florida that have dried up, a river in Massachusetts. Massachusetts has a river that dried up? Indeed it has. The Ipswich River has gone dry in 5 of the last 8 years. This isn't in Arizona or Nevada, an arid state. This is in a state that gets more rain than Seattle. So having said that, I also offer a set of reforms about what we can do about it.
Our local situation here in the towns of Nottingham and Barrington with the Save Our Groundwater people is that a company came into town, bought a piece of land, and intended to put a bottling plant and pumping station on that land and pump thousands and thousands of gallons of water per day and export it. The local residents were very concerned about the consequences of this activity and looked into it and found lots of reason to believe that it would, in fact, have a lot of negative consequences for the surrounding area. And they did all the things that you would expect a group of people to do. They signed petitions, they went to meetings, they petitioned the governor and the legislature. They did all of the things that, in theory, are supposed to let individuals prevail over private interests in our country, but they keep losing. Is there a way to use the current law to have citizens in their position get a fair shake?
Well, yes, but if they win in the courts, then the law is in their favor. It's when they don't win in the courts, can they still win in the real world of politics? And the answer, Steve, is yes. And the example I would give you is one I describe in the introduction to Water Follies. It's about people in Wisconsin. And the people in Wisconsin had a proposal for a bottling plant by Nestle, the Swiss-based food giant. the largest bottler of water in the United States. And the law in Wisconsin permitted Nestle to drill a well and to pump and to pump and to pump, but the citizens were just so spirited in their opposition that eventually the company said, you know what, it's just not worth it. Why don't we go to another state where we're not engendering this kind of animosity from the local community?
Our local situation is not, does not involve a global multinational corporation, but it does involve a somewhat local business. I believe they're from Nashua. They are not in the same position as Nestle. They don't see the whole world as a place for them to extract water from. But does this business of just making them want to go away work in such a situation?
Well, that may not, that may be the case. But having said that, there are still ways that the pressure can be brought to bear so that there are either restrictions on how much water he takes or an outright ban. He has no right to take this water. Water is a public resource under the management of the state, and the state has every reasonable, can set every reasonable restriction on the use of this resource. So there's no reason to give up hope at all. The problem with bottled water is this. There's nothing wrong with drinking bottled water or being in the business of bottling water. If you think about it, drinking bottled water is better for you than drinking Coke or Pepsi or beer. And if you think about it, the bottlers of Coke or Pepsi or the brewers of beer use vast quantities of a public resource. But those activities are activities that are already well established and in some instances have been occurring for generations. What bottled water presents is a new demand on a resource that is already stressed. That's what in part distinguishes the situation with bottled water. And what we need to do, to go back to the original idea, is to break the tragedy of the commons. We can't let this bottler or any other bottler come along and put a new demand on an already stressed resource.
One of the particular elements of the local case is that, unlike other uses of water in the area, when someone comes in to withdraw water and bottle it, it goes out of the aquifer. If people use water locally and it goes through a treatment plant or their septic system or whatever, that water remains in the neighborhood. The thing that has particularly aggravated people locally is that none of this water will be in the neighborhood. It's going to be trucked out and sold wherever it's going to be sold. And they see this difference between heavy uses of water that stay around and heavy uses of water that go away.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. In the buzz of water law, it would be called a consumptive use. And most water uses have what's called a return flow, where some of the water recharges the aquifer from which it was extracted. But when you put it in a bottle and ship it out of state, it's 100% gone. And I haven't seen the figures on what he proposes to pump, but the story I tell in Water Follies is of Nestle proposing to pump between 500 and 600 gallons per minute of every hour, of every day in the year. That turned out to be almost 750 million gallons of water. So a little bit of water per minute adds up to a lot over the course of a year.
In reading your book, I was really struck by the number of very, very shocking and frightening consequences of overpumping of groundwater. There was the couple in Florida who bought a house with a pond which disappeared. There were huge sinkholes that appeared as a result of large removal of groundwater. There were damage. There was damage to fish when a river ran low or dried up. Can you tell us about some of these things?
I'd be happy to. The sinkholes in Florida are a function of pumping so much water out from underneath the ground that the ground literally collapses of its own weight. The water that had been in the ground was supporting the overlying surface. And it's not just Florida. The ground has collapsed in many places around the United States. So that's the problem of subsidence. And your second question was?
We've mentioned the lowering of the water supply in wells. We've mentioned the earth subsiding. What are some of the other consequences of excessive water removal?
The problem with groundwater pumping can, I think, be understood by your listeners if they think about this riddle. Where does water in a river come from if it hasn't rained recently? And the answer to that riddle is it comes from the ground. It's moving subsurface laterally to provide flows to our rivers, lakes, springs, creeks, estuaries, and wetlands. And when you pump a lot of groundwater, you change the direction of flow. So instead of the gravity taking the water subsurface into the river, it now takes the water away from the river. And this creates a problem for inland rivers, and it creates a problem for rivers out by the coast, because in the past, it was thought that any water that reached the sea was wasted. It could have been captured. It could have been put to human use. But we now know better, and biohydrologists and others who deal with species tell us that the water that goes into an estuary provides critical habitat for nursing fish and other species that reproduce there. They receive nutrients from the fresh water that comes into the estuary, and equally as important, they receive protection from the saltwater predators who won't come into the intertidal zone because of the mix between fresh and salt water. Well, golly, if now you dry up or greatly reduce the flow in the river from groundwater pumping, then you're not providing the nutrients to the species that inhabit the estuary, and you're encouraging those predators to come up and chomp down on the shrimp and the oysters and other critters that depend on that estuary for spawning.
In another example, you cite simply the lowering of the water level in wells. The couple in Florida who had a prolonged battle.
That's one of my favorite stories, though it's only funny if you enjoy black humor, which I do. Scores of lakes in Florida have dried up. I mean that, scores of lakes. And the story I tell was about a Midwestern couple, young kids. Steve Monsees was in the military in the first Gulf War, and Kathy was his wife. And they bought a piece of property on a lake in Florida in the late 80s. And this was to be their dream retirement home when he finished with his military tour. So they built a house, and then the tour ended. And in the early 90s, they began to live on the lake in their house, and the lake dried up. Now, they did everything you're supposed to do in a democracy. They wrote letters, they attended meetings, they made inquiries. They got nowhere. Eventually, it became obvious that Tampa Bay Water, the local utility, had these immense well fields located right down the street from their property, and the water had been literally sucked out from underneath their lake. So at that point, Tampa Bay Water now realized it had a major public relations disaster on its hands. So it figured it had to do something. And what it decided to do, unbelievable as it will sound, is to refill the lake. And the part that just makes me smile, and the reason why it's a folly, and in my book, Water Follies, is that they decided to refill the lake by pumping more groundwater. So they dried the lake up from pumping groundwater, and the solution of these bright engineers was to pump more groundwater. We human beings have an infinite capacity to deny reality.
You mentioned Rube Goldberg in connection with this. It really is very much like these crazy machines that go through all sorts of contortions to do something that could be done in a much simpler way. You also mention areas where the soil subsided, as we mentioned earlier, wells simply reduced in quantity. What are some of the other sorts of evidences or consequences of this taking too much groundwater that have occurred?
Well, there's two or three that are important. One is it then costs you more money to pump. And it doesn't sound like much, but water is very heavy. And if you're pumping from deep in the earth, you're looking at huge electric bills. For farmers in the West, it's multi-$1,000 electric bills for every well every month. Then there's a decline in the quality of the water, because there are some things that occur naturally, like fluoride, arsenic, and radon, that aren't particularly nice to have in your drinking water. But when you pump from lower levels in the earth, the warmer temperature of the earth's internal temperature lets these things go into solution. So you get a decline in the water quality. And finally, this is at least of interest for the 17 miles of New Hampshire along the coast, is saltwater intrusion. And all around the United States, from down east Maine, through Cape Cod, down the coast, across the Gulf, up the California coast, and all the way to the islands off the coast of Seattle, we are having saltwater intrusion. And Steve, it's nothing more complicated than this. You pump the groundwater out, you create a vacuum, water likes to fill the vacuum, the salt water fills that vacuum by flowing laterally into the aquifer, and not only have you taken some of the water out, you've then contaminated the rest of it with salt water. It's a very major problem.
If you are someone who gets their water supply from a drilled well, and someone starts pumping large amounts of groundwater somewhere nearby, what is the legal situation? Do you have to prove that it is in fact their pumping of groundwater at that particular site which is causing the level in your well to go down? Or how tricky a legal issue is this?
Well, it's not a readily demonstrable fact. It's a fact that can be proven with hydrologists. But there's an old adage, a bit of a joke really, that in cases like this, the party with the burden of proof loses because it's just so difficult to prove. But it's worse than that. In most states, Steve, it doesn't matter whether you can prove it. If I go in right next to you and put in a well, and your well dries up because my well is pumping more water for, say, ag use, and you're using it for domestic use, in most states, Steve, it's your tough luck. That's one of the reasons that I think this is a classic illustration of the tragedy of the commons. It's a finite resource, but we allow limitless access to it. And if I could just make one more point, some people think, well, it's my property right to put in a well. It's my property right to use the water beneath my property. Well, actually, this doctrine, this reasonable use doctrine, is the antithesis of a property right. A property right is your ability to exclude people from your property. But if you've got a right to use the water, but someone else, a bigger pumper for agricultural irrigation, comes along and can displace your use of your well, what kind of property right is that?
What about environmental groups who are concerned with the environment at large, not specifically involved with water, but the Sierra Club, the Audubon Society, these other national organizations, are they up to speed in terms of understanding this as a problem? And are they helping to fight this business of excessive groundwater pumping?
Waterfall is, believe it or not, is the first book ever published to focus on the problems of groundwater pumping for the environment. But in the back of Water Follies, I have an appendix of national and local groups that are engaged in this. Right here locally, you have Save Our Groundwater. Around the United States, you have groups like American Rivers that have been fighting hard for this, and there are other groups that are really taking notice. I've gotten a remarkable response to this book.
I understand that earlier today you met with legislators and the governor over in Concord. Was that a productive undertaking for you?
I did. Your governor is very sharp, and a quick study, and I had a nice session with him. And then Jim Ryan, the legislator, arranged for me to have a couple of different sessions with his colleagues in the state legislature. And there are some people that are working very earnestly to reform New Hampshire's law. They've already done a pretty good job. I mean, there's a fairly recent limit that now requires anyone who pumps more than 57,000 gallons of water a day to obtain a permit. That's quite a step forward. At the same time, it leaves a lot unregulated, because 57,000 gallons times 365 days in the year is 21 million gallons. Well, that's a heck of a loophole, and when you multiply it times all of the potential wells that would have that exemption, all of a sudden the rule begins to be swallowed by the exception.
And didn't Perrier or one of them put in multiple wells to get around the usage quantity?
That's happened in the state of Washington, where a developer of a subdivision took advantage of the exemption for homeowners to be able to put in wells for their individual homes, and he was clustering wells around a whole subdivision, putting in a well that would serve five or six homes, but putting in six or eight wells to service five or six homes, and suddenly you had a large number of homes that he claimed were no longer subject to state regulation. The state of Washington has closed that loophole, but it illustrates again that there's no particular reason to single out bottled water as any worse than any other new user. All new users are putting a strain on the resource. And what we need to think about, going back to my metaphor of the milkshake glass, is this. If you're coming along and you want to put a new straw in that glass, put a new demand on a public resource, then it's incumbent on you to pinch someone else's straw, just like you were sharing a milkshake glass. You need to buy out. You need to retire someone else's water use in exchange for permission for you to put the new straw in the glass.
You mentioned in your book the enormous amount of water that is used for irrigation agriculture. I think the figure was two-thirds of the water use in the country is used for this.
Two-thirds of all water in the United States is used for agriculture, and in the American West, it's even higher. Typically, the figure is tossed out at about 80%, but in a state like Idaho, it's well over 90%. And the scary thing, Steve, and I hope we get to talk about Minnesota and French fried potatoes before we're finished, is that there are now folks who are irrigating right here in New England for blueberries. They never used to irrigate blueberry barrens down east. Now they do. There are folks in Florida growing small grains with irrigation. In fact, the banks won't give them loans unless they have an irrigation plan. And there are folks in the Midwest, all across the Midwest, who've turned to irrigation to get greater yield. That is a huge new demand on water.
Now, those circles we always see when we're flying in airplanes that are formed by these irrigators that travel around in a circle in a field, that use of irrigation agriculture, the pumps are right there with the irrigator itself?
That's exactly it. There's a pump in the middle where the well is in the middle where the water's coming from. The source could be electricity. It could be an automobile engine that's been re-geared. It could be a turbine engine. It could be a steam engine. You just need some power source to move the water. And they just pump and pump and pump. And what's happened across the country, particularly in the poster child for exploitive water use, which is the Ogallala Aquifer. And the Ogallala goes from the panhandle of Texas all the way up to the Dakotas. And in the 1950s and 1960s, new technologies allowed people to pump from well below the surface of the earth. And drill bits allowed deep wells to be dug, and boy, the race was on, and the pumping commenced, and water tables plummeted.
And you've got to tell us about French fries in Minnesota.
Well, that one's a great story. I think your listeners will like that. Potatoes are almost all water, and your listeners have had that experience of taking a bag of potatoes, putting them under the kitchen sink, forgetting that they're there, and coming back. And either they've grown things out of them, or most likely they've just shriveled up. They've become dehydrated. Well, the genius of Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, was to realize that if you want to make a great French fry, you have to start with a potato that has a high water content. Because the process of making the fry is the process of extracting the water and replacing it with fat. That's why they taste so good. That's why Americans consume on average 30 pounds of French fry per person per year. So in 1986, McDonald's went one better. They used to sell French fries in little wax paper bags that would spill over and make a bit of a mess. But in 86, they went supersized. And now, of course, you buy French fries from McDonald's and they come in a flat bottom box, the orange-red color, with rigid sides. From that point on, McDonald's would only buy potatoes from farmers who irrigate, because if you irrigate, you get what's called in the trade an industrial potato. You get a potato that has the same uniformity as the headphones you're wearing or the microphone that I'm speaking into or a computer. It has the same color, no different coloration to the potatoes, especially the same shape. And your listeners will appreciate this. When's the last time they went to a supermarket and saw potatoes that were odd-shaped? They're now all the same. Well, that's a product of irrigation. And finally, and most delightfully, the same length, the length just necessary for the potato to stick out of the supersized carton and be grabbed between thumb and forefinger and dipped in the ketchup. And, of course, it's related to the environment because they're pumping. In Minnesota, the story I tell in Waterfall is they're pumping from a well located right next to the river, and the river's a blue ribbon trout stream that's being threatened by this groundwater pumping.
There are people other than homeowners with wells who are going to be up in arms about the consequences of excessive groundwater pumping. I think of fishermen, for example. I'm sure they're not going to be happy about the effects on game fish.
Well, I think that's right, but it's more than fishermen. It's all kinds of groups who care about the outdoors. Duck hunters, anyone who cares about wetlands and waterfowl, for that matter, aren't birders as concerned about this? Aren't recreationalists, kayakers, canoeists, people who just like to see the flow of water in a river or a spring or a beautiful lake? It's really, for me, been stunning to watch the citizen activism in the state of Wisconsin as they fought long and hard to keep Nestle from building this plant. And the spirit of La Follette progressivism is alive and well in Wisconsin. And I have to tell you, I see a lot of that that backbone and gumption here in New England.
I think you'll enjoy your meeting this evening with the Save Our Groundwater people. They're a very tough bunch, very tenacious. And they have, in spite of a lot of setbacks, have just kept at it.
Well, I've already met a couple of them in Arizona a couple of years ago, and I think it's a great group, and I'm really looking forward to seeing them this evening.
Well, Robert Glennon, thank you very much for meeting with us. The book is Water Follies, the author Robert Glennon. And we appreciate your taking the time to talk to us.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on your show.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.